This week, we are pleased to bring you one of our most popular episodes of 2024. Please enjoy, and we'll be back next week with more insights from the Corruption, Crime, and Compliance podcast.
Trying to sell compliance program or Trinity program as a new thing, as we are going to start from scratch, like we're going to build something new. That was not the right way to approach this opportunity or this problem. A word, a concept, quickly became popular in these roundtables. Rebuild and rediscover. We need to rediscover our values. We need to rediscover our purpose, our mission. So this effort was joined by the legal team, by HR, by environmental team, by safety team, by different teams that are involved in what I call the cultural environment of a company, right? Because we're all areas involved in establishing some standard and practices that affect the people's behavior.
Global companies face unprecedented risks and challenges in today's economy. To mitigate these legal and economic risks, companies are rapidly embracing and elevating the importance of robust ethics and compliance programs to promote positive corporate citizenship. On Corruption, Crime, and Compliance, you'll hear from industry leaders and insiders about how to create effective ethics and compliance programs that will mitigate risks and maximize financial performance. Here's your host, Michael Volkov.
Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome to Corruption, Crime, and Compliance. We have a special guest today. First with me is Daniela Melendez from our law firm. And we have a special guest, Carlos Villagran, the Director of Compliance from CMPC, which is the 100-year-old Chilean-based holding company and the leading manufacturer of pulp, paper, packaging, personal care, and other forest products. Well, first off, Daniela, of course, welcome to Daniela. It's great to see you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Mike.
And Carlos, it's just a pleasure to have you and really an honor because we're going to talk today about rebuilding a corporate culture after a corporate crisis. And Carlos, great to have you here. Thank you so much for making time available with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Michael, for inviting me to your podcast, you know, and again, giving us the opportunity to share with you guys, with the audience, part of the CMPC ethics and compliance journey. It has been a journey. I think it's an experience we like to share. I think it can be of great help for other companies and compliance professionals. And you know, by the way, Michael, I'm a huge fan of this podcast. So I really hope to rise to the occasion.
Well, look, it's our honor to have you. And let me just tell our listeners just a little bit of background about Carlos. He's now the Director of Compliance at CMPC. And as I mentioned in the intro, this is a well-established 100-year-old Chilean-based holding company, one of the worldwide leading manufacturers of pulp, paper, packaging, personal care, and other forest products. It has close to 20,000 or more than 20,000 employees, industrial operations in 9 countries and Latin America and the US, as well as commercial offices in the US, Europe, and China, selling and distributing its products to more than 45 countries around the world. Now, Carlos is a Chilean attorney who graduated from Pontificia Universidad Católica, apologize for my Spanish, de Chile, with a master's of law degree from Georgetown University. Now that I can say because I went to Georgetown. He has previously served as compliance officer for the Chilean operations of Liberty Mutual Insurance and Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group, as well as a legal extern at the World Bank's Integrity Compliance Office. Welcome, Carlos. Welcome, Daniela. And we're so grateful to have you visit with us today to discuss your current work at CMPC, and in particular, the challenges you faced when you assumed your current position as Director of Compliance at CMPC after a major corporate crisis. And I think, just to set the tone a little bit here,
sure.
I think that everybody can learn from this because, for example, I mean, this is a crisis that occurred, but lots of us in this profession face situations where, let's say there's an internal investigation, there's a major scandal. It may not result in an enforcement action of some sort, but nonetheless, you have to remediate the situation. And I think that the skills and the principles that Carlos is about to talk about are applicable in any of those situations.
Absolutely.
But to start, Carlos, can you give us some background of what happened at CMPC and how you were recruited to assume the position as director of compliance.
So I will take just a few minutes to provide some background about this major corporate crisis that CNPC faced some years ago. It is usually known, if you go Google it, it's known as the tissue cartel. You know, and basically, my company, CNPC, not just created and participated in a cartel, but actually was the leader of a cartel with the other competitor in Chile and Peru to assign market share quotas, to set sales prices for products in what we call the personal care products, you know, affecting pretty much, you know, everyone in those two countries, given the nature of those products, you know, that are wholesale market, basically. But at that time, we're talking about 2010, 2015, when this was investigated, both subsidiaries in Chile and Peru, I'll say they were quite a small subsidiaries within CNPC. We're not talking about the biggest subsidiaries. And this gives you an idea that even a small crisis that affects a small part of your business can have like an organic impact in the whole group, right? So at that time, CNPC Tissue, that was the name of that business, Chile and Peru were very small subsidiaries. Two out of, 20 or 30 subsidiaries. In 2014, CNPC becomes aware of an investigation that is being conducted by the antitrust authority in Peru. That's when everything starts, Michael. It was an investigation that was being performed by Peruvian authorities that affect our local subsidiary, CNPC Tissue Peru. And that gave us the first alert as a company. And CNPC started an internal investigation, including Peru, Chile, Mexico, and Colombia. Everywhere where we had that business unit, that personal care business unit in those countries, because we thought, or the company thought at that time, this was happening in Peru, it might be happening elsewhere, right? But the thing is that at that time, 2014, nothing was found. Executives that were interviewed during that internal investigation, they didn't talk about it. No red alerts, no red flags, nothing. It was completely silence. So at first, CNPC thought, okay, this is just a rumor. Maybe the local authorities in Peru or in Chile, I don't know, they want to know more about this market since considering the market share of CNPC, it's a high risk, antitrust high risk market. But anyway, local employees didn't collaborate in that investigation, so nothing was found. But 1 year later, now the Chilean antitrust prosecutor office started an investigation against CNPC and other companies in that industry. So CNPC resumed the internal investigation with new interviews, with new executives and key employees. From what I know, the scope of the investigation was broader than the one that was performed 1 year before. And now a couple of employees decide to speak up and serious antitrust infringement, such as, you know, collusion with a competitor, are right. Identified. And the thing is, Michael, that once the investigation started, the company realized that this had been happening for more than 10 years in Chile and Peru, from the year 2000 to 2011 in Chile, from 2005 to 2014 in Peru.
It didn't extend into Mexico. It didn't extend into Colombia, anything like that.
Exactly. I will say that control weaknesses were found in Colombia and Mexico, but antitrust infringement were only found in Peru and Chile. And the company decided to self-disclose the situation to both authorities in Peru and Chile, giving total and absolute collaboration, not only to, you know, I would say that was the first characteristic of how CNPC reacted. It was not just about trying to get some benefits from those prosecutors, but it was about being transparent about what happened. And the aftermath, you know, CNPC was fine. In Chile and Peru, we're talking around $30 million. Executives were fine, were terminated. Company was required to implement a compliance program. That was the first reason why I was hired, but not the only one, by the way. The company reached an agreement with the National Consumer Office. As I think this is important, Michael, because it gives you the idea of the impact of the situation.
I mean, these are products that everybody uses.
That's it.
And so the impact on your reputation or the company's reputation, you know, it's not like it's a specialized product. Every consumer knows now that CNPC was involved in this, and they're paying more money than they should have.
You know, even if our customers were like supermarkets or retailers, the final consumers were, you know, everyone in those two countries. I remember at that time, Michael, that I was not working for CNPC at the time, But I remember my wife, my family was so mad against CNPC, with CNPC, really? That we decided as a family, stop buying CNPC products. Everyone was doing that, you know? And if you went to a supermarket, it was usual to see like a spontaneous protest performed by consumers that they decided to throw all CNPC products to the floor or away or to the garbage as a way to protest. I mean, this really touched like a nerve in both societies, Chile and Peru. And even if you go online and check about this case, you will see the public impact of this case. I remember actually, Michael, just to give you a short example, a quick example. Shortly after that case, a couple of years later, a national survey was done just to understand how the citizens, the population were feeling about all these cases. And pollution cases, such as the one that was led by the CNPC, was in third place behind corruption in politics and Catholic Church abuses. The worst problems of the country, and as a top form of violence, people felt that collusion, especially in this market, was a form of violence. I think this is very important, thinking about the reputational impact.
I have a question. What triggered the investigation by the Chilean authority?
So what we know is that CNPC had a very important market share in Chile and Peru, especially in Chile, I will say, and new competitors were trying to get into the market at a local level, especially Walmart at that time with what they call their own products. They produce their own products with their own brand. That created some noise in the market, some questioning. You know, the expectation of having Walmart joining the local market was okay. We expect the prices to lower a little bit because we have a strong new competitor, but that didn't happen. And the National Prosecutor Office, they have their own business intelligence unit. This was not because of a report, but was more like an alert that was given.
Wow. So it was probably from a competitor who couldn't break into the market. And look, that's Walmart is going to be aggressive, is what I'm
thinking. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, continue on with the story. I mean, the background. I mean, you're still not in there yet. This is all the stuff happening before you get there.
That's right. Again, you can imagine that even to this day, collusion cases, especially the one from CNPC, it's considered a top form of violence for companies in the private sector in general. I remember CNPC is a very traditional company and is owned by a family that is really well respected here in Chile. And you don't usually saw family or these executives of this chairman on the public stage. They usually were more like low-key kind of a traditional company. At that time, and you can find that this easily online, the leaders of this family, of the oldest of this family, start giving like interviews. And I remember one that was still remembered to this day, in which the chairman of the company, that then he resigned, he said that he felt deeply ashamed. And that was like the main news of all national newspapers, was that this guy of this very traditional company is saying that he's really and deeply ashamed. I'm giving you this example just to give you an idea of the true impact within the company. It's not about paying, you know, a fine or reaching an agreement with the National Consumer Office in Chile, which was a big agreement, about $150 million, a voluntary agreement to try to compensate final consumers. It was about the spirit. It was about the legacy. It was about the history of CNPC, you know. And I think that gives you an idea, Michael. I will explain that later, on how the company decided to face this crisis. You know,
it's interesting because that corresponds with we've heard from directors of companies, and what they say is, I mean, they don't use the word shame, which I think is even more personal, but they say it's not the penalty. It's not the, you know, that hurts. It's the reputation, the damage to your perception of your company and who you are that has been jeopardized. And here it is to be sort of a leading business entity within Chile. And then all of a sudden you're feeling shame and you're responsible to all of this controversy. So to me, it reinforces the idea that it's always your reputation, your culture, your sort of feeling of self-worth that is jeopardized when something like this happens, acknowledging that you did something wrong.
A big impact, I will say, that just paying a fine. You don't only lose clients or vendors, but you also lose talent. I remember I joined the company in 2018, 3 or 4 years after this huge case became public. And for a couple of years, I had to work with HR during the onboarding process for potential candidates for executive positions within the company. I had to help HR convince those guys, the new executives that the company was hiring, that we were making everything we could to prevent this from happening again, and showing them that they were reluctant about accepting the offer to join the company because of what happened. And I always give this example because besides losing clients, market share, or your money by paying fines, there is something that is even, you know, I would say more critical for companies. We start losing talent, people that decide to quit the company, and other people that decide not to join the company because of what happened.
Right. That's another real significant collateral consequence is what you're saying. So anyway, you're sitting in, I guess you were at the World Bank at this point. How did it come about that you ended up coming to the company? What they sure. reached out to you or what happened?
So I was living, we were living with my wife and working in the US. She's also an attorney. She was working for an energy firm, energy company in Virginia. I was working for the World Bank. And we were like preparing to move back to Chile at that time. I had the opportunity to go back to my previous job. We was in a Japanese bank. But then I got a call. I got a call from a headhunter firm, very prestigious headhunter firm in Chile. CNPC was looking for a compliance director. Now, at the beginning, I thought, you know, I can think of at least 5 or 10 other people who were experts, you know, who are way more prepared than I am for this challenge just in Chile, you know. But it quickly realized that following these interviews with the headhunter, then with the chairman, with the CEO, and then with my boss, the general counsel, at CNPC, they were looking for a different type of person, a different set of skills, an attitude, a fresh viewpoint. They want to rebuild this compliance program, but far from a traditional compliance approach. For them, and it became clear since the first interviews, this was not a legal issue. It was cultural. Again, we're talking about 10 years. Okay, it's not just a small group of employees, Mike, that actually became crazy and started doing crazy stuff. It was more of a cultural thing. And most of these executives who were actually part of this cartel within CNPC were very prestigious and renowned executives, many of which actually received awards, such as one they used to call the CNPC Spirit Award, that it was to show the company that, of course, the company was not aware about this situation. But anyway, their style of doing business, it was something that was recognized throughout the company. So for CNPC, if they wanted to rebuild the compliance program, they wanted to move away from a legal perspective and trying to think in cultural terms. So because of that, they were looking for a more fresh viewpoint. I was like, I don't know, 34 years old at that time. I don't have a ton of experience, to be honest with you. My experience was mostly focused on highly regulated industries in which doing compliance is way different than for all
right.
from that, that for
other
manufacturing is completely different. Yeah. But it became immediately clear that they were looking for somebody, you know, different. And I remember that we talked, Mike, some weeks ago, and you asked me about what gave me like the assurance to take this challenge, you know.
Yeah.
And I can say very quickly, first of all, the new chairman that was appointed after the scandal and the CEO, they were clear that,
was
you know,
the CEO knew.
We don't know to this point, the former CEO that was the CEO of CNPC at that time, he was like a mythological figure, not
right.
only in CNPC, but in Chile. He was terminated. He said he didn't know, and I believe him. He didn't right. know, but that shows how the silos work within CNPC and the lack of visibility the senior management had of the business, of what was happening. I think that the best assurance I received, Michael, that came from my boss, from the general counsel. This is crucial because of what happened later. So Rafael Cox, my boss, he was appointed as general counsel during the crisis. But he was an insider. He was from the company family. I mean, from the CNPC family. That's what I mean. Right. He was a senior in-house attorney at the time who, due to all the internal changes, he was entrusted to lead the legal strategy of the company to address the crisis. And he still is, but he was very young at that time when he received that assignment. He was alone. And because of how he performed that duty in such transparent, honest, humble way, he's still recognized today as a key leader, as a champion, as a leading voice for cultural evolution process. He was trusted. He was visible. He was an attorney who, you know, stepped out of his like comfort zone. In Spanish, we have an expression, tomó el fierro caliente. I don't know if you, Daniela, have the same expression, like the hot iron, or like you took with your own hands something that is, was very risky, complicated, you know, and that can burn you, right?
Right.
The company in the last years have been working in a very interesting cultural evolution process. And they are always, is conducted by HR, and they are always inviting executives to talk about their experience working for CNPC. The one who is mostly invited to talk, to mentor the other executives, it's my boss, because he talks about CNPC from what he saw during the crisis, which was painful for him. It was an enlightening process as well, but he makes it in a very natural and honest way. And he acted, when I joined the company in 2018, and he still acts today as a way of, like a corporate bridge. The company terminated a lot of executives, being hired a ton of new executives or outsiders, which was very against CNPC history, but they needed talent from outside, right? My boss stayed as a corporate bridge, as a general compass, and he was the one who gave me that assurance. We want, this is not a legal issue, we want to change our culture. We have the diagnosis, the materials, the resources, but we don't know how to start. We need to, of course, solve some important issues, such as implementing an antitrust compliance program to comply with those two rulings in Peru and Chile. Sure, that's your first duty. But then we need to talk about culture. And I think that conversation actually gave me the assurance that, okay, this is a huge challenge, of course, but I can see, I can hear that the leadership of the company, they are all looking in the same direction.
Yeah. So that's where you got the assurances. And we've always heard, I mean, we all hear in this field, some people get assurances, false promises, and then they get on the scene and then they wonder, why did I take this job? Because it's not true. But here, what's fascinating about this is these were real assurances, and you had the support of everyone at the top, and, you know, probably within the company too, that we need to get this done. We need to survive. We need to change. I think people need to take a lesson learned. You really need to test the assurances that you receive before you move your family, before you move your job. And I've heard of situations where people left after 6 months because it wasn't true. So you do move your family, you do take the job, and you get in as the director of compliance. And what do? How do you start? You know, there had to be days where you said, wait, why did I do this? Was I sure about this? You know?
You know, I do remember the first month, I was bombarded from everywhere with a lot of information. The company, of course, worked with some very prestigious law firms, consultant firms, who wrote very spectacular reports, assessments about what happened, why did it happen, action plans, you know, ideas to improve the compliance program here and there. But for me, the true challenge was, how do I start? How can I start working? What should be the first step to address this problem? Again, the diagnosis was already on the table, and I want to just spend a few moments with this. But first of all, this was not what happened, was not a matter of bad apples. You know,
right.
Mike, I hate that concept of bad apples, because you never perceive yourself as a bad apple, right?
Right.
And I love this phrase from this part of our book from Travis Vaught, from Compliance Training to Change Behavior, that says that people do not wake up, you know, in the morning with the intention of ignoring the law or behaving unethically. That's the result of competing objectives, context, lack of awareness. And that's what happened here.
That's a great way of saying it.
You know, and first of all, I try to avoid that perception of bad apples, because again, that will give the false idea to the company that, okay, we terminated those guys, problem solved, right? That
right.
Never will happen to me because I'm not a bad apple. So first of all, I try to understand that this, at the beginning at least, happened because the company, the business team, was under a lot of pressure with high incentives like performance bonuses to perform in an aggressive way. The message from key business leaders was, be aggressive. We cannot allow to lose market share. If you look at the testimony or the interviews of these former executives that they gave to the court, you will see that they use words, expressions such as, we were very aggressive. I heard some rumors, but I didn't, you know, think it was real. I didn't think that it was my problem. Again, it was like a culture, a subculture within these teams in a way, like justify how they behave. So kind of the diagnosis was already there. No speaker culture. The compliance program was pretty much on the paper, like a checklist compliance, to right. be honest with you. So that was the diagnosis. And secondly, CNPC was recognized from the beginning from addressing this problem in a very transparent, collaborative, and humble way that really struck a nerve in local employees. You know, so my first challenge was, how do I go from this like a first responders approach to a formal work plan, a true strategy? And first of all, what I did was, okay, I will be fully honest with you. I lost a couple of months by just gathering my ideas, trying to put everything in order. As I told you before, I was bombarded by information. So what I did was, okay, what I will do is that I will use these first 3 or 6 months to get a better understanding of the business. I knew nothing about the business. So how can I speak to those guys, right? To train them, to provide some guidelines, standards, and practices if I don't understand the business. I don't understand the operation. I don't understand the history of the company. I remember I read several books that the company has issued in the last years about the company's history that comes from 1920, like the first workers union in Chile was the one in CNPC. So the company has a very rich and interesting history. I start getting into that, visiting the plants, the mills, having a one-on-one conversation, trying to turn that diagnosis into like a diagnostic, into a real thing, into something that I can use to develop this work plan. So the first thing that I did after I spent like 3 months thinking about what I did by joining the company, accepting this job was, okay, I will go back to the company because these guys, and this is still part of our culture, there's a strong sense of ownership within the culture, within the company. Like, this is our company. So it really easily became clear that any kind of compliance program had to start by listening and listening and listening again, those employees, those executives that stayed, and they wanted to be part of the solution. And they had excellent ideas. They were like, let's talk about good practices. I want to talk about the hotline. What about do's and don'ts? I'm worried. I'm concerned about going to my work on a daily basis. I start receiving this. But the first sense that I received from these employees, some of them were acting with fear of penalties, jail, and such. Right. But most of them, they wanted to get involved. You know, they wanted to be part of the action and they have their own responsibility. So what we began with was with these round tables, not workshops or big training programs, but round tables in order to hear again these employees, how they were feeling, what they were their concerns, and trying from them to express what compliance and integrity meant for them. That was the first step. And then we spent like almost a year just doing that.
When you say round tables, you would bring together certain groups from different functions
yeah.
and, you know, tell us how you are perceiving everything, you know, give us your ideas. Well, there are two words I want to talk to you about related to that. One is you say listening, which I think is phenomenal. I think to listen and really listen and encourage them to express themselves and for you to be, you know, an interested listener, I think that helps to establish a trust that they have with you. Like you weren't coming in saying, this is the way this is going to be done. You're saying, tell us, I want to hear from you. What's the best way to do that? But I also want to go back to one other word you used early on. And that was, so you're listening, but did you also hear shame? Like what were people feeling in terms of, did they express similar feelings to what the chairman, the former chairman said about the shame? I mean, these are people who are operating at a very high level in Chilean society, in business, the business society. So those yeah. two words seem important to me.
I would like to add to what yeah. Mike just said. I want to know, like, if there was a team, a compliance team that helped you, or if you recruited more people, and also how is it nowadays? Like, do you have different compliance people in the right. different countries?
So when I joined the company, there was no compliance function, no compliance team. I had to hire to build that team. Today we have an in-house team in both in Chile and Brazil. Brazil has become, at this moment, I'll say the most important jurisdiction or country for CNPC. CNPC is now, I'll say, more a Brazilian company than a Chilean one because of the importance of the assets and the business opportunities we are exploring in Brazil, I start hiring my own team since the beginning, and considering that my bosses, the board, they were asking me for a fresh viewpoint. Of course, I hired a couple of attorneys, but then I moved to data analytic experts, IT experts, internal audits, auditors, engineers. One of the things that I always highlight from my compliance team is that I have a very diverse workforce with different skill set. Because I start looking around, and most of the compliance team in Chile were full or packed by attorneys. I'm an attorney myself, but I know my own limitations. And you know, I thought at that time, this is a way more complex company than a regulated one, with people that actually work in the forest, at the mills, at the plants, at the corporate office. I need also different kind of skill sets. And that's how I start little by little creating like a small team. Today, we are 8 people working within the compliance department in Chile and Brazil. We're now expanding our team in Mexico and Peru as well. We had all the champions and ambassadors of compliance, but the team, the corporate one, we're talking about 8 people so far.
So let's go back to the listening, you know, the right. Roundtables. And you say that took up to a year. And then where did that get you then? Where did you go from there?
It quickly became clear to me, Mike, that trying to sell compliance program or Trinity program as a new thing, as we're going to start from scratch, like we're going to build something new, that was not the right way to approach this opportunity or this problem. A word, a concept, quickly became popular in these roundtables. Rebuild and rediscover. We need to rediscover our values. We need to rediscover our purpose, our mission. So this effort was joined by the legal team, by HR, by environmental team, by safety team, by different teams that are involved in what I call the cultural environment of a company, right? Because we're all areas involved in establishing some standard and practices that affect the people's behavior, right? But again, that word, rediscover, rebuild. It is not a construction site. We're not going to, you know, demolish everything and start from scratch. It's not about that. It's about rediscovering what makes us special and rediscovering what made CMPC great at the same time some years ago. Now we're at different lenses, of course, from a different perspective, with different methodologies and technology, of course. But that was how we start working, and that how we start, we began with the Rediscover initiative that now is part of the cultural evolution process, which is like the third iteration of that process. And we start with establishing some general, I wouldn't say rules, but like most of these employees and executives, they were eager to receive like do's and don'ts one pager. You know, again, they wanted to be sure that they were doing the right thing. So first what we did, it was, okay, these are the do's and don'ts in a very practical fashion. This is not about long legalistic policies and procedures. This is about guidelines. We talk also always about guidelines, do's and don'ts, and right. There are gray areas. We have an expression in Latin America, rayar la cancha, you know, where you play soccer or football, as we call it, and you have the field, and the field is always, you know, you have boundaries in the field. One thing is that, okay, I know something. I know that I don't know that, so I will take care of that. The biggest issue for these guys was, I don't know what I don't know, actually. We haven't run a thorough risk assessment process. So that was, at the same time, we were like issuing and training on these guidelines, on these integrity guidelines that then became the integrity policy and integrity program. We were working very hard on a risk assessment to, you know, update the risk profile of the company, the risk appetite of the company, et cetera. And of course, our third step was to relaunch the CMPC hotline, now from a more, I would say, a speak up culture kind of stuff. Actually, today, that was hotline. If you see something, say something, you know, speak up, et cetera. Today, 2024, we are now talking about if something worries us, we speak about that freely and openly. That's part of our current communication. So those were, like I would say, the three first steps we gave at that time.
But going back, it started from rededicating the principles and values of the company. And I think that's an important point here. We always talk about corporate culture and how do we embed the corporate culture? How do we promote it? How do we advance it? And what's clear from the research, and you and I have talked about this before, from LRN's research, for example, is that leading through values and principles rather than rules. Okay. In other words, rather than rules, and it makes so much sense when you think about it, but that's what you're saying, basically. When you started to rebuild and rediscover, I love that phrase, you started with the values. There must have been a little bit of a challenge because here's a 100-year history of a company, and you're saying, we're not just new people on the block. We're now an established company, but we have to go through a rebuilding process and a rediscovering process. And what a to get buy-in for that must have been hard. But also, I think that's the most essential thing that you probably did. We can all draft policies, procedures, controls. We can, you know, have say speak up and please do so. But it has to start with the foundation of what you're talking about, Carlos, which is the values and principles.
Absolutely. I mean, people really connect with values. You know, you have your own system of values within your family, within your friends. You perform on a daily basis, not only at your job, but on your society, according to some values, some of which can be expressly written or some can be just shared. So we started by that and by engaging key business leaders of the company. Mike, we are now in the fourth year of this training program that is specially designed for a business leader. And the name of this training program is Words and Action. Maybe you remember that one of the questions made by the DOJ in this guideline for how do business leaders remember with their words and action?
And words aren't enough. You know, people think the CEO does a statement, puts a video out, and it's words. It's not words because people watch, do they really mean what they're saying? What do they do? Yeah.
So at the beginning, in terms of training efforts, we're talking about a 20,000 employees company. We said, okay, we need to focus. CNPC has changed a lot, but at that time, it was a very vertical company, meaning that the boss is God. Everybody has to follow those orders. A lot of the yes men, yes women, like a kind of culture. So I said, okay, we're going to use that in our favor. That means that we are able to convince business leaders about the responsibility within the ethics and compliance program. We will be able to make huge steps. You know, we are now moving towards a more horizontal company, more diverse, sure. But at the beginning, in order to deliver a strong and quick message, quick in terms of 1 or 2 years, business leaders, those guys were key partners for our action. And that's why we created a special training program just for them. Words and Action, Ethical Leadership Training. Words and Action, you know, we used that DOJ question at the beginning of those trainings, which says, how do leaders with their words and action impact or promote an ethical behavior of their employees? And then I get the floor to them. Tell me, guys, words and action, not just words and not just action. How do you on a daily basis do this? Quickly with my team realized that these guys, they were listening, they wanted to be part of the solution, but they didn't have the tools to promote ethics and compliance. I mean, how can I do that? You know, on your daily meetings, in your performance evaluation process, by speaking up. And we start talking, giving those guys real clear, you know, and very practical tools to put those words and those actions, you know, in the right direction. And quickly, using that kind of a culture of CNPC, this vertical culture, we start getting or like moving this huge ship little by little, you know, moving towards a different narrative. And we start little by little creating what we call now an integrity narrative. Actually, now my team, at the beginning, my team was morely organized by like subject matter experts, like this guy, this girl is expert in antitrust, anti-corruption, internal investigations. Now we have moved away from that. And now I have like a narrative leader, risk assessment, operations, and standard and practices. Those are my four functions within my team. Regardless if they are attorneys or engineers or IT experts, we move from more like a subject matter expert way of doing compliance to a more functional way that actually resonates more for the company, you know.
That's interesting. Say those again, the four functions that you have.
Sure. So we have narrative and training.
Right. Narrative.
That's one. Standard practices and risk assessment. We have operations and continuous improvement.
Terrific.
That's like business as usual and continuous improvement, meaning data analytics, indicators, metrics. And then, of course, we have internal investigation. That's the fourth.
That is fascinating. And you know what? I mean, maybe that's a model for the future, Carlos, in terms of how compliance should be looked at in terms of how you organize, because we're still seeing the same thing, you know, anti-corruption, antitrust, trade.
Not the private, yeah, nothing, yeah.
You know,
trade compliance.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we see these sort of, I wouldn't call them a silo, but a function within compliance.
Right. What I tried to do here, Mike, was trying to mimic the business. I took a very deep look at the business, at operation, supply chain, commercial, sales team, innovation team, and I start looking at production team, et cetera. And I start trying to see how those guys were organizing their ways of working. And I said, okay, one way to approach our job to the business is trying to work as they do. And that's how why we move from this SMEs kind of perspective, right? My expertise does not define me. You know, part of my maturity model of my compliance department means that we're moving away of our expertise, which is still there and available for the compliance program, of course, but that does not define my role within the integrity program. That's why we're still moving towards that.
And I think it maps well, when you think about it, to this movement that's going on and the need to develop holistic risk approaches. In other words, we can't just sit there and do due diligence and say, is it a corruption risk? Now we have to know, is it a cyber? Is it a business risk in that, are they going to pay us? We have to look at a holistic approach. And now with sort of the sustainability movements and, you know, the sort of global movement toward a holistic approach on looking at risk, mm-hmm. I think that ties in well to that, Carlos, in terms of what you're looking at.
You know, we start looking at the company, and the company, they were talking about lean excellence. They were talking about Six Sigma. I mean, different kind of methodologies to improve, to make more efficient. And then we as a compliance team, last year actually, we found like an idea that really resonates for us. Following like an MIT course with it. And it is system thinking. We are surrounded by systems within the company, within our organization. And we are just one additional system. We do those systems. And that pushed us as a team to look into processes from an end-to-end perspective. Because you have this temptation about like putting small compliance controls here and there, without looking at the big picture, right? The full process of all the stakeholders and routines and such. And now when we have to intervene following an internal investigation, a risk assessment, or a training program, you know, to solve a problem, we do that, but from a more system thinking, you know, perspective, trying to see that this is part of a major system, which is part actually, what I would say, of a value chain of the company that can have an impact. So we have to involve everyone who is part of that line of process into our compliance solution.
And what that does is it embeds you in a more positive way with the business. Now you are part of the business process. Now yep. you have that seat at the table because you're a part of the process. And I've always believed this, that compliance can be a value add to the business, no time flat, no problem.
That's totally right, Mike. Actually, you asked me before in a previous meeting, I remember, about how do we define success, right?
Right.
Or objective. And it took me a while. I was preparing for this. And I think like I was thinking about metrics and indicators and KPIs. But then you know what? For me, actually, it's the biggest sign of ultimate success is the number of important key or critical tables we are seated on. Meaning, has the compliance team has been invited to join executive committees, key initiatives, projects? Does the business see that we are adding value to their work? I mean, for me, the great sign of success is having, I don't know, the business director, the manager, I don't know, calling me or my team and saying, you know, we're thinking about doing this or that. It will be big, huge impact. No, we would like to have somebody from compliance on board from the beginning. Not sure what, for what exactly, but I know, and it was part of our meeting yesterday, I know you will be asking tough but necessary questions. And we want you to be part of this process from the beginning all the way with us. Okay, that for me is the biggest sign of success, that the company is seeing that we are useful, right?
Yep. And to me, it means that just say the likelihood of you finding a red flag has gone up 1,000%. On the other hand, the likelihood also at the converse side is you're going to help them to be more efficient. You're going to help the business. And here's why. Because first off, you have line of sight across the company. You know what's going on everywhere. They may not know everywhere. You may bring information to them and perspective. And you may say, you know what, this is interesting because somebody over here is doing something similar to that. You should talk to them. Or because you are an information source, you bring lots of marketplace information about vendors, about third parties, about customers, about everything. You bring lots of information about the company and external, and you bring that to the table and you give them that, they're going to love it. They're going to see the value. And that story you just told of what happened recently, that's what people are hoping to accomplish. That's what they want to accomplish. They want to be the support.
You know what we do now that we're working in that way? Is that we ask the business to challenge us. Our solution has to make sense for them. Now the company is going through a very important competitiveness process in order to be more agile, more efficient, et cetera, and such. So what we do now as a compliance team is every time we have to design a special control or process or routine to reinforce an ethics and compliance model, we pass that solution through agile and efficiency lenses. And we ask the business, challenge us. It has to make sense to the business, because for me, the worst scenario, Mike, is to create like a compliance artifact, trying to embed that in the company. And a couple of weeks ago, nobody's complying with that, or nobody's doing as you thought they were doing. Because if any breach or infringement happens, in any authority start investigating you, if they see that you have declared that you are doing something in one way, but you're doing it in a different way, well, you already, you lose the game.
You lose your credibility.
Your credibility, absolutely.
Well, Carlos, this time has gone by fast, but it's been fascinating. And I really want to thank you so much for your ideas and sharing just really sort of cutting edge ideas and experience. To our listeners, if any of our listeners want to reach out to you to sort of discuss ideas or to follow up on anything, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Absolutely. You know, I teach at several law schools and universities, business schools as well. So I'd really love to share good practices, ideas, especially the things that have not worked, not only the good ones, but the bad ideas as well. So I will be more than glad to share with you my personal email. Feel free to contact me at cfvillagran@gmail.com. That's cfvillagran@gmail.com. I can give you later if you can add it to the, maybe to the podcast.
No, we'll put it in the show notes because it has
absolutely
in it. We really appreciate that. And thanks. We'll put in our show notes your contact information so that people can reach out to you. Daniela, thank you for helping us with this. And Carlos, it's just been a terrific experience. Best of luck to you. You know, maybe we can check back with you in the future about, you know, how things are going and any new ideas that you have, because I think just this simple idea of restructuring the compliance department has got me very intrigued, very intrigued, very interesting and very cutting edge. So thank you again. Good luck to you and everything. We're just really excited for you.
Thank you so much, Michael and Daniela, for the opportunity. It has been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode, the best way to support the show is by subscribing on your favorite listening platform. To learn more and connect with Michael Volkov, go to volkovlaw.com.